Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Tanger Outlets, find hundreds of brands at unbeatable value. Save big on outerwear, must-have handbags, active essentials, classic favorites, footwear, and more up to 70% off. Shop Nike Factory Store, Coach, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. All the best brands, all on sale, every day. Only at Tanger Outlets.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're here to talk about the Ravens' very dominant Week 4 performance against the Browns on defense. Excited to talk about this. It's a great time in Baltimore sports. We're going to go into that a little bit. And here to discuss it with me is Brandon Croxton. Brandon, how you doing?
Hey, Ken. I'm doing great after a great win like that. It's always nice to get a big win, a very controlling, very dominant win, especially against a division foe.
Yeah, it's incredible. The week this week, obviously, they're just coming off the Browns win, and we get to enjoy that for the whole week. And I think if I had to say, I would still say the Browns are the biggest competition that the Ravens have for the AFC North at this point. And the Ravens may or may not be good enough to be one of the top teams in the AFC North with the injuries they've had, but we hope they are. And they've got a leg up in terms of divisional record. But I would say the Browns are the best of the other three from what we've seen through 3 weeks. And to lay a loss on this like them, even when they have their backup quarterback, is very gratifying, particularly in the factory of sadness.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that is a talented roster that they have and a very talented defense. Miles Garrett is an absolute game wrecker, and I thought he played an outstanding game against us, but we were able to make enough plays to combat just to counter his dominance. And, our defense played lights out. They might have had a backup quarterback, but that's still a very good offensive line, if not one of the best in the league. They still have a lot of talent, and the Ravens were just absolutely able to shut them down in every aspect.
Right. They still have Amari Cooper as a wide receiver, who certainly is one of the better ones in the league. Ford is not an untalented running back, but he's no Nick Chubb. Their tight end group is pretty good, but Njoku came into this game with a significant burn issue. I don't know if you saw him show up to the game in a mask.
Right,
it just looked scary as hell.
Yeah. Yeah, I was impressed with that. Yeah.
He played through it. He had a visor on, so you couldn't really see what had happened to his face in the I guess he was burned somehow around the house. But anyway, more injuries this week are the bad news. So why don't we get that done with first? Moses, a shoulder injury. They say, whenever I hear shoulder, I hold my breath and I wonder if it's a pec.
You hope for the best with that. Possibly maybe his shoulder just popped out and popped back in, like a dislocation or something like that also, which is not good, but is something that he can work through and hopefully be better in a couple of weeks. But yeah.
Have you ever had an injury like that? Now you play defensive line, but maybe teammates where they had a dislocated shoulder and they end up playing in a harness after that.
Oh yeah. I had a dislocated shoulder. And it's not fun. I was out for about 3 weeks. My shoulder popped, the socket popped out to the front of my shoulder, and it was it's not super painful, but it really weakens all of the muscles around your shoulder, so it becomes very hard to play. And once it pops out the first time, it can hop out again a lot easier than any time before. So
is there usually some break or chip that comes loose for it to happen, or it's just, it creates space and then that space can be exploited again by additional impacts?
The ligaments that keep your shoulder intact get stretched. And once they stretch, they don't tighten up back to normal. So when they're looser, your shoulder or really kind of any joint becomes a lot easier to, you know, possibly tear or dislocate again. Like it can happen with your knee, ankle, things like that as well.
All right. So maybe we don't project on Moses that this is the injury. I certainly hope it's not. I would hope it's a stinger, you know, and that it can be rubbed out and worked with, and they just didn't put him back in the game here. But I don't think we honestly know at this point. Worley also came up with something that looked like a shoulder injury. Again, you know, we don't know exactly.
Yeah.
I didn't hear anything today from Harbaugh about Daryl Worley. And then JAD had a hamstring injury.
Yeah. And it's, you know, guys keep going down with these injuries, and it didn't sound like anybody was a major injury, which I think is a positive thing. I guess we got bad news about Ojabo possibly being out for the rest of the season, but I think they were saying there's a decision that he has to make on that front. But I mean, these smaller injuries just keep piling up and they become a pain in the short term, but to be positive is, you know, hopefully a lot of these guys will be coming back over the next couple of weeks to a month.
Yeah, we certainly hope that. And obviously got some big ones that potentially coming back. We did get Linderbaum back in this game, Keaton Mitchell, Tyus Bowser, Ronnie Stanley, still on the shelf, and hopefully we'll come back soon. We don't really have good information on Dafe Owe, I don't feel, currently, about when he might be back.
Right, exactly. And hopefully Marlon Humphrey will be back in the next couple of weeks too. Harbaugh said he hopes to see him out in the practice field this week, and so maybe he could suit up Sunday for, you know, a limited reps or something like that, and maybe be full go the following week.
That would be a very cool timeline. I'm buying one of the Brandon timeline there. We talked a little bit about Ojabo. When Harbaugh says he has decisions to make, that means only one thing to me. It means he has to decide whether to have season-ending injury or try and play through it to the end of the year.
Right.
With some either amount of pain or the potential for the injury to be made worse.
Right, exactly. And yeah, it's pretty unfortunate to have that, you know, have a very hard decision with that. I guess he's really got to decide what's going to be best for him in the long term, like, because whatever injury it is, if it's possible that it could get worse and they lose him anyway for a year or even, you know, going into 24, that's really going to set him back as far as, you know, his development. And exactly.
It's very serious. And obviously it would probably have been better if Ojabo could have been NFI'd for the entire season last year. It's not typically the deal, although I do understand that's the deal with Voorhees, as far as we know it right now, that he won't be activated at some point to practice later in the year. And the Ravens should still have 4 years with him, but we'll see how it ends up playing out. Brian McFarland actually is on the other side of that. He thinks that the Ravens will not try and take a year of credited service time away from Voorhees, and will eventually let him get activated at some point this year. I don't know that they'll have room, sure, honestly, on their 53-man roster at this point, so I don't know how they do it. You know, this game ended up 2 hours or so before game time. Maybe it was three. We heard the news first reported that Deshaun Watson was not going to play, which completely changes, like any good starting quarterback being out, which has an untested rookie backup. It significantly changes what the game plan will be.
Right, exactly. And the Ravens are usually very tough on rookie quarterbacks, no matter what their pedigree is, whether a first round pick or a later round pick. And they did not make life easy for DTR yesterday.
Yeah, we see now CJ Stroud, and obviously he's right at the top of the first round. Dorian, DTR was a sixth round pick, I believe. It might have been a five. but one or the other.
He was later.
Mm-hmm. C.J. Stroud had a 78 quarterback rating with 5 sacks in his first game against the Ravens. Since then, he's been the talk of the NFL with a rating well over 100 the rest of the way. And he has 6 touchdowns and no interceptions for the season right now. So he's 6-0 since then, since that first game against the Ravens. It really puts things in perspective with how Houston really handled Pittsburgh, a good defense this last week.
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, it's a testament to how well the Ravens defense is playing because, I mean, C.J. Stroud could not move the ball. I mean, it would have taken him 5 or 6 quarters to get his first touchdown against the way our defense was playing. And he's been lighting up everybody since. He looks like a real potential franchise quarterback for them. So, yeah, it's encouraging to see, you know, how well we played against them. And, yeah, it's exciting to see.
Yeah, very much so. In this game against Dorian Thompson-Robinson, the Ravens only allowed 73 net yards. They had 121 yards of passing offense, lost 48 on 4 sacks. By the way, that's pretty hard to do. Those are long sacks, but they had a team sack for minus 18 and another minus 13. But anyway, nice group of sacks there. That compares to 88 interception return yards that the Ravens have.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's that's pretty rough right there. You basically have a net negative on total yardage on passes. Yeah.
Now I know you look at statistics very much, and you had some other good numbers, which might be great water cooler fodder for people who want to take the information gained from this podcast and take it to work tomorrow with them. But what did you find statistically in terms of anomalies that were exceptional?
Yeah. So number one, just to show how inept the Browns offense was and how well the Ravens defense played. So the Ravens had 13 plays of 0 or negative yards that were not incompletions. So obviously an incomplete pass goes for 0 yards. These were either completed passes or runs that were stopped for 0 or negative yards in 13. And that is just an absolute huge number. I mean, considering most teams get between 65, 75 plays in a game, and you almost 20% go for 0 or negative yards.
They happen to have exactly 65 in this game, by the way.
Okay. Uh-huh. See, yeah, right there. So, yeah, to have that many, and you know, all these negative plays, they set an offense back so much and give such a big advantage to the defense, because now you're behind you're off schedule, you're behind the sticks, and the defense can just tee off on, because they know you have to pass and you have to get downfield, and they can key on that.
Yeah, it's that's an incredible number, I'll tell you that. And it wasn't a ton of runs for 0, though they had a couple of them at least. They had a couple, maybe a pass for 0 as well. They had 1 pass for 0, I think, on my sheet here. But it was a lot of negative plays in there, including a run for minus 20, which was among the funniest football plays I've ever seen.
Gosh, I couldn't believe Elijah Moore. It's like, just go. I'm screaming. I'm just like, just go down, just go down. You're just, and at the same time, I'm like, yeah, keep going back. Take it back to midfield. It's absolutely just a boneheaded play, and I'm glad they were able to get him down finally. After he lost 23 yards on that play.
20, I think, but he was very elusive on the play to get back to escape trouble, and you thought maybe he'd escaped it the one more time, but there was a little bit of contact while his knee was down, which is just great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think there is kind of one overarching theme for how McDonald schemed the defense up against the Browns in this game that I think is really worth visiting, because I think there are two ways that you can go about trying to have a big advantage defensively. And I'll say the A way, the better way, the way that a lot of teams have done it over the years, but it usually requires a lot of resource investment, is to have a great 4-man pass rush. So you could do it. You could be the Dallas Cowboys of the 1970s or or the Rams of the late 60s with their fearsome foursome.
Fearsome foursome, yeah.
Yeah, the Purple People Eaters. And any of those defenses had great front fours that could get after the quarterback with four men and get there often, right, with frequency. And we're going to talk a little bit about what the Ravens did in this game as well. I think the B way to accomplish a similar thing is to be able to play nickel pretty much whatever your opponent presents you, including 12 personnel, to be able to have defenders who are flexible enough to defend the run and pass. And the real key thing comes down to is with the nickel, you can usually defend the pass pretty effectively. But what you can't necessarily do is defend the run, because you're working with a lighter box of six men, and then you have to get other ancillary contributions from safety and slot corner usually to get those additional tackle opportunities. And that's where a lot of teams, it just doesn't work for them. The Ravens, historically, that has been their way. It's the B method, but it has been their way in history. Is they could always stop the run with six. And they did it by having unbelievable edge setters, great interior players who are always extremely stout, and they always valued that in terms of drafting defensive linemen, and then great off-ball linebackers in the middle who would make plays. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about Bart Scott or Ray Lewis or Mosley or Roquan or Patrick Queen now. But they all really could get the job done in terms of defending the run.
Right, exactly. And it really starts up front. And the defensive line, especially the interior line, has really handled and controlled Cleveland a whole lot in this game. I mean, Cleveland's guards, Betonio's the multi-time All-Pro, and Teller is a really good guard as well. Like, they have a really good offensive line, and just the whole defensive line. And you know, and then you include Clowney and Van Noy. They shut down the run. Like, they could not run the ball at all, like inside or outside. And you know, Roquan and Patrick Queen were flying all over the place, and it was really very encouraging to see, and very exciting to see that kind of dominance from your front.
They did a very good job of getting after Jedrick Wills in this game, who's a left tackle, and he's not particularly good. I would also say DeJuan Jones didn't look that good to me. I know he came out at the end of the game. I didn't see who replaced him, but he was, oh, it was Hudson, right? The guy who projected to a guard when he's drafted a couple of years ago. But anyway, DeJuan Jones looks like, honestly, he looks just like Fa'alele to me, which means he's really not ready to be on the field. He's 6'8", 374, so right there you've got a lot of similarities in terms of size and heft, and he's got very slow feet and has a lot of trouble managing his balance easily at that size, gets beat outside very regularly. But also, you know, for a 374-pound guy, I saw him getting bowled a fair amount.
Yeah, that's very discouraging to have that kind of bulk and somebody just be able to push you around like that.
Pride becomes an issue there. But he's got a very high pad level, so whoever he's going against is going to have some pretty significant leverage against him, right?
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
So, and then you got to be careful of that. So that's why, you know, 6'8" is. You know, thought to be great. And if it translates to arm length, then I think you can derive value from it. If it doesn't translate to arm length, I'm not all that excited about it. If you're 6'8" with 33-inch arms, I don't think that's a good thing at all, for example.
Sure. Yeah.
I want to talk about the overall Ravens simplified approach here. And I'm going to go through three elements here. They played a nickel with a four-man front on all but two of the offensive snaps. So they only went to the base defense twice. They didn't go to anything else the entire game. So normally I have this packages section that's in my article, and it has, you know, typically five packages maybe per game, where they maybe played a couple snaps a dime, and they had a couple different types of nickels, no differentiation of any sort. It was all nickel and with two base plans. And the two base plans were the DPI for 37 yards, which doesn't even actually count as a snap as I count them up, but it was a play that occurred on the field. And then the second one was the run for minus 20. So the rest of the plays, that nickel success was off of the freaking charts. And I want to just get to that briefly. Let me bring it up for nickel here in this game. So with five defensive backs, They had 63 plays, and so there's one also kneel down at the end of the half that's excluded from that. So it's 63 plays, 188 yards. That's 2.98 yards per play with four sacks and three turnovers.
Fantastic.
You got no reason to leave that defense if the offense can't prove they can somehow beat it.
Right, yeah. I think when they realized that DTR was starting, they just decided, hey, if this fourth or fifth round pick can beat us passing the ball, that's how we're going to beat. And we're just going to beat you up, you know, running the ball. Our defensive line is just going to beat you up. And if DTR can make enough plays to win this game, go ahead and do it. And we're going to bet that he's not going to make those plays though.
Yeah, I first of all, I agree with you. I think that they basically started the game with that. But they're free to adapt as DTR proves he can beat them. But he never did. I mean, he never was completing big plays on the field. So it didn't leave – it didn't take away the option. He didn't bet the whole game at the start, is my point, that they were going to do this. It's just, you know, he was put in the wonderful position, McDonald I'm talking about, that he never had to make changes to a basic scheme that was working play after play after play.
Right. DTR, he looked like he was not ready to start the game. I mean, I think it's certainly possible, you know, he got reps in practice apparently, but it sounded like this decision was made a couple of hours before game time. And it's like, right. Hey kid, you got the ball. And he was just not ready to play. He either mentally and physically, he just wasn't ready to be out there.
Yeah, reportedly, since Watson has been limited all week, DTR was taking a lot of the first team reps at practice. So You'd hope he'd be ready. But honestly, you know, there's ready fifth year career backup ready, and there's ready rookie getting his first NFL playing time after a week of practice.
It's kind of fun, interesting. Like they're saying, it was Deshaun Watson's decision not to play in that game. Like, a couple of the players said everybody was expecting him to play. And then at the last minute, he made the decision that he was not going to play, and DTR gets the start. So
All I can say about that guy is he really deserved to have the camera on him all game. And I know they wanted to do it because they want to show the interaction between him and Thompson Robinson. I'm just going to call him DTR the rest of the show because it's too hard to remember that he's Thompson Robinson, or he might be Thompson. I'm not sure. But they wanted to show the interaction between those two. And, you know, they got a little bit of that when Watson would go over and he'd talk to him. But then, you know, you get into later in the game and it's mostly face palming from Watson after some of the interceptions. There's some clear, you know, this isn't working kind of stuff. I will say this regarding the decision to play at all. He has taken a lot of heat on the Cleveland boards for not playing this game. So their logic, and it's fan logic, so let's not go too deep into this, was that it seems to be a pain management issue, number one. Number two, it doesn't affect any contract that's coming in the future for Deshaun Watson. I mean, unless you think there's some injury that can be made significantly worse because it's some sort of fluid buildup in the shoulder. So There might have been pain involved, but probably not a worse injury risk, and that they really thought he should have gut checked it out and played despite the pain and try and make it work.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And I can't blame him for, you know, being upset because he's not playing for a contract. He's fully guaranteed for the next 3 years after this one. So
yeah. And you know, there's even if you're thinking about like what other bizarre groups might actually be interested in making sure that he plays, I put the NFLPA at the top of that group, because if you're gonna have fully guaranteed contracts, those players better freaking play. And if the NFLPA isn't telling him, hey, look, this is you've already got two and a half strikes against you for the contract you signed, given you missed a half season of that, and you know, there's still all the legal mess around what occurred. Now, he may have cleaned all that up, by the way, but there's still all the bad aftertaste of it at the very least. Then you had a really bad year last year. Then you had a really bad first two games of this year. You finally got it going in week three, and you're going to sit out week four in what potentially is the biggest home game of the entire season against the biggest divisional rival because you've got some fluid buildup. That is not setting a good precedent for the next guy, whether that's CJ Stroud or somebody else who comes along earlier, who's going to want a big, fully guaranteed 5 or 6 year deal.
Sure. Exactly. Yeah. It was terrible to give him that contract, to give him that contract, and it's bearing itself out.
Yeah. All right, we talked about a little bit about the four-man rush, but I want to talk about this a little more because this was the most extreme pass rush game I've seen from McDonald in his time here. So they had 40 plays that resulted in a pass or sack. There were some other scrambles in there too. I don't include them in that total, but there were 40 total that resulted in a pass or six. 36 of those times, the Ravens used a four-man pass rush. That's a 10% blitz rate there. They had 2 fives and 2 sixes to go with that, which is dramatically lower than the Ravens total, which is typically in the 30s in terms of the blitz rate they use. The four-man pass rush. Now, I know your expectations would be you could occasionally get pressure with four men, but it's much harder to have a consistent four-man rush, and that's why teams that can do it effectively are so damn good. But on the 36 plays, the Browns gained 84 offensive yards on those 36 pass plays, 2.3 yards per play with 3 sacks and 2 turnovers. So first of all, 3 sacks out of 36 is an 8.3% sack rate with 4 men. That's astoundingly high.
You'll take that every week if you can get it.
Oh, of course. Yeah. You'd probably take it overall from all your pass rushes, included 5s and 6s, unless you're one of the greatest sack teams out there. The 2006 Ravens did generate a four-man pass rush sack rate of almost 10% for the whole season, which, thinking back on that, it still boggles my mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they had a lot of great pass rushers, but they were very blitz-heavy too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, this is another thing. If you can sit back and rush the quarterback with four and have some good success, and I didn't even tell you the pressure rate, but the pressure rate was 45%. On those 36 plays, they got 16 of their pressures. Oh, that doesn't work out exactly right. And it was 45% overall. It was 18 out of 40. It might have been 16 out of 36 on the four-man rushes. So that pressure rate is astounding given the fact that it was basically all four-man pass rush. And, why would you ever change if you could do that? And obviously the Ravens are having lots of success with having 7 in coverage.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yep.
All right. The last thing I want to talk about was the zone defense they played against Robinson and mobile quarterbacks. It's well known because we have Lamar Jackson, of course, that you want to play zone defense against mobile quarterbacks because they, when they leave the pocket, you want to be right on it. You want to have potentially spies, but you really want everybody on the field to know when the quarterback's leaving the pocket if you can, which means you give up some easier throws to make that happen. So you should give up some throws usually in front of you. You typically won't give up as many deep throws because it's harder to beat a cover 3 zone or even a cover 2 because you've got safety help coming over. With a split field, the safety can get to any throw to his side of the field. That's right, right? I'm not making a mess of that, right, Britton? Yeah. A single high, you can't really get to the sideline is the big difference. But there's another advantage here in playing against a rookie quarterback is that I think they make a lot of mistakes with their eyes. They either stare down a receiver or they go through their reads in such a way that a savvy inside linebacker, in this case, Roquan Smith, but Patrick Queen also played well in terms of coverage, would be someone who can figure out where the ball is going from the way the eyes are going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you could really see it. I mean, Roquan had 2 near miss interceptions, and there were a couple other plays where he saw the receiver that was coming across and absolutely decked him and leveled him. Mm-hmm. And it was even on the interception by Stevens after Millett tipped the ball in the air. Roquan was coming like a missile. He got some of the receiver and most of Mallette on that play. But I mean, if even if that ball was, you know, even remotely thrown accurately, like Roquan would have, yeah, just obliterated the receiver. So
yeah,
he was all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah. It is. Stroud's accuracy, if you want to come up with a gun analogy here, and I'm not a big gun guy, but Jackson in this game was a sniper rifle and Stroud was a sawed-off shotgun in terms of where that ball was going. A very broad accuracy issues he had to do. And you know, the other group, the inside linebackers did well, but the safeties did well too. They played very patient back-end defense. On the interception by Stone, he was what? 7, 8, 9 yards behind the receiver on the play.
I mean,
and he needed most of that.
They were playing in Cleveland, and DTR threw that thing to Cincinnati. And,
there you go.
And Stone was just there, one of the easiest picks you'll ever have, right there.
It was a terrible room service thing. I thought the Hamilton pick was a pretty easy one too. The Stevens one was a great reaction to the ball and a great tip by Mallette. But it's not; those weren't the only interception opportunities the Ravens had in this game. Queen, I don't think he deflected the pass, but he was going hard into Njoku, and it looked like Njoku made a business decision to hold up on the play, and he might have tipped it himself, but he didn't go all off for that ball with Queen coming right at him. And the ball went back to Stone, who had to reach out to get it. It was just a little too far and glanced off his hand rather than being collected. They had two balls batted up at the line of scrimmage. One by Urban, one by Van Noy. Those are always high probabilities. And when I say they're lottery tickets, but you know, they might be a 20% probability of interception when those things happen.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
Just definitely a good set of interception opportunities in this game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yeah,
I was just saying, like, that's why you want to play a lot of zone. Is you get seven eyes on, 14 eyes, but seven guys. 14 eyes and seven players, you know, all looking at the quarterback, seeing, you know, and when he was as inaccurate as he is, those are just great opportunities for tip drills and easy interceptions, and he gave them a lot of them.
Yeah, that's, you know, that is really the point here. It's eyes on the quarterback and how often you can do that by playing these zone defenses. And the other statistics where it's really showing up, the Ravens don't have a lot of interceptions. They only have four on the season, and there's several teams who have more. But they're second in the NFL now in PDs with 25. And they've played, you know, Joe Burrow had the ball out quickly a lot and wasn't giving them a lot of PD opportunities. They played Gardner Minshew. Some of the same here. This was a big game for PDs. I think they might have had 10 in this game of their 25 on the season. And they probably had a few against Stroud as well. And I'm not, you know, saying they didn't have anything because they had the 15 somehow split among the other three games. What has not been exceptional so far, and it's not terrible, but it's just not great, is they've only had one interception per 6.25 PDs. So four out of 25. Normally, you'd like that number to be about one every five. And I think I looked at the league as a whole, and it was slightly under one every six so far this year. So it may have been they've become a little less likely than they had been before. But the number of times they're getting their hands on the football is extremely exciting. And boy, would Ravens fans have ever guessed it at the start of this year based on what their secondary looked like.
Right, exactly. When Marlon Humphrey went down, I think everybody was, we need to trade for somebody, you need to get somebody. And I mean, Rakusen has come back and has played well. Darby has played very well. And Brandon Stevens has absolutely just broken out this year. I mean, he's gone from, you know, maybe a quality backup to, you know, an above average starting cornerback. And, you know, when Marlon gets back, they're going to have, you know, the good problems of figuring out how they're going to rotate all of these guys in and keep them all fresh and keep them playing as well as they have been.
Let's stick with this point now since we're here. But that is, I think, one of the big questions for the Ravens coming down the stretch here is how do you reassimilate Humphrey back into a group where you might believe you have your nickel now, whether you believe that's Mullett or Hamilton. And we got to talk about that one. Let's leave that problem for separate, because the slot corner and what they do with the safeties is kind of all intertwined. But let's just talk about the outside corners. If they have Humphrey, they've given Stevens all the snaps. I would assume this means he stays on the field, you know, as we move forward, but they may start rotating him. Yasin can't even get on the field for any reasonable number of snaps. I mean, he's been healthy, and he only played a limited number of snaps in this last game. And I'm using the game book number for this one, but Yasin only played 25 snaps while Darby played 44. And that's been pretty similar in terms of the ratio between the two through these in the weeks since Yasin has come back. Mm-hmm. So what on earth do you do with these guys?
Didn't you know it's possible to get THC shipped right to your door? Mood delivers premium 100% federally legal THC directly to you. I'm talking about delicious high potency gummies, top shelf flower, home baked cookies, vapes, anything you'd find at a dispensary. You can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently right to your door. And every Mood product is made from pesticide-free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code RAVENS. So head to mood.com/ravens, check out their online dispensary, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code RAVENS when you check out to save 20% on your first order.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel, because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Save on your next oil change at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Choose Castrol Edge Full Synthetic Motor Oil to provide maximum performance and protection for your engine. Get a $15 gift card after rebate when you buy 5 quarts of Castrol Edge for $34.95. Plus 2x O Rewards points. Offer valid in-store and online at O'ReillyAuto.com.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Get the playing time. And I hope your answer is not, well, we'll have some more injuries and we'll figure it out, because we know that's probably the reality of the situation. But what do you do if they're all four healthy?
Well, that's certainly a possibility. But I mean, I think obviously Marlon's got to be in there, and he's got to be in there virtually, you know, 100% of the snaps, depending on how healthy his foot is. I mean, the way they're playing, you can kind of slowly move Marlon in more and more and ramp him up a little bit if you know his foot isn't 100% healthy, to get him 100% healthy. And I think Brandon Stevens, is the way he's played these four games, he's really earned that other starting cornerback position. And you not only want him to get more reps for this season, you also want him to get more reps for 24 and 25, because Darby and Yasin may or may not be here next year, but Stevens definitely will. So you definitely want to get as long a look from them as you can.
Yeah, you know, great point. And they lost their fifth round draft pick because they just couldn't find a space for them, even on this mediocre group of corners that they had. And now they've lost JAD to some sort of hamstring injury. I don't think there's any question he's going to IR, even if he might be back in 3 weeks, just because the roster spot has more value than what he would offer the team on special teams during that time.
Agreed. Yeah. I mean, JAD's at the bottom of the roster depth right now. And yeah, they'll need somebody to fill his shoes for special teams.
By the way, I apologize, folks out there, but you can probably hear I'm sicker than a dog right now. We're just trying to make it through this episode, but really enjoying this conversation with Brandon Croxton, and always love talking football with him. I want to get back to the zone defense component of this, because it's been so effective through 4 weeks. The Ravens are only allowing 3.75 yards per play right now, and they lead the NFL in that statistic. Per pass play, they are very similar to that because it's just about equal run and pass. I'll take a look, quick look for it because I've got that right here. I'll bring up the right spreadsheet here. So, yeah, they're giving up 3.8 rush yards per carry and actually only 3.7 pass yards per play. So just absurdly good numbers. Let's put this in context. I believe the 2000 Ravens gave up only 4.3 yards per play. The 1999 Ravens, I believe, were the best ever, and they gave up 4.1, if I recall correctly. So this is an unbelievable start to this season, and they lead the NFL in that particular category in terms of yards per play. So the question I would have is there any impetus, or should the bias strongly be for the Ravens to continue with a cover two zone pretty much regardless of quarterback for as long as it continues to work?
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
There you go.
All right. That's what I'll say. I mean, they have really been playing excellent team defense. They are very disciplined. They're not missing assignments. I mean, if you think back even to last year, like the Miami game, one of the Tyreek Hill touchdowns, somebody blew an assignment and, you know, Tyreek went uncovered for a 50-yard touchdown. And, you know, they had plays like that against New England also. And they're not having these breakdowns. They're not having mix-ups and coverages. They are playing excellent, disciplined team defense. And it's really very impressive to watch right now. I mean they're not giving up big plays. And the longest play that they've given up has literally been that defensive PI
against for 37 yards. Yeah,
for 37 yards. If you take out that 40-yard run they had in garbage time when they had some of their backups in, the next longest play they've had all season was 34 yards. In this modern day NFL where you can pass the ball all over the place, the defense can't touch you, and everything that's, you know, skewed to the offense, to not even give up a 40-yard play through four games is very impressive.
That is very impressive. And more than that, you know, yak opportunities happen. So even if you're playing pretty good defense, you know, running back gets free on a screen pass, and or, you know, Zay Flowers or his cousin gets free in level two, you can easily give up a 40-yard play even when it's not a coverage breakdown. Per se, you might miss a tackle to do it, but you even when it's not a coverage breakdown, you can do it. So that's extremely impressive to me in terms of what they did. It's a good stat to have right now through this point. Let me get back to this a little bit more, because here's where I was kind of winding up to in terms of the question very slowly, is do the Ravens need to consider keeping Hamilton at nickel because of the impact of cover two? So they had Darrell Worley playing on the back end. Darrell Worley, for a game and about 10 more snaps than this one, played some fantastic safety on the back end. Made every play he was supposed to make. Tackles were all made. Had a PD, I believe, in this one by the sideline. He was completely fulfilling the Hamilton back end responsibility for his time there. And nobody would throw at it, in particularly Minshew in that third game. Was not throwing into the area even between level two and three because of the risk that would come with that. I'm not sure you need to have Hamilton back there. And I damn well know that Hamilton up near the line of scrimmage is an absolute terror in terms of pressure and other things he can provide you in terms of run support and whatnot to very significantly support trying to defend the run against a six-man box and add to your pass rush as well as zone coverage responsibilities.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way Hamilton is playing, he's really found his spot where he can be a threat and a terror on the offense at that slot corner position. And you have a lot of really nice coverage safeties back there. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's a really good depth. Like, you have Geno Stone, Marcus Williams going to be coming back in, you know, hopefully a week or two. And then, yeah, hopefully Worley's not hurt too much. And then they have the guy on the practice squad,
yes.
Harmon, who's also a more traditional free safety, can play back in that cover too. And yeah, when you have that much in depth, just let Kyle, he can play the deep safety, but let him wreak havoc inside and close to the line of scrimmage like he has been.
Yeah, I mean, I'm for it. And then the one, you know, shadow on that came up just this last week is Arthur Maulet, all of a sudden out of nowhere, is playing great slot corner. What do you do with him? Do you sit him after he did all that? Or do you, you know, let him play slot corner on some sort of basis, meaning against certain receivers? So if it's 12, it's Hamilton up and playing that tight end, which is probably going to be a base defense anyway, the way the Ravens like to play it. They'd probably be just, it wouldn't be a play where Maulet would be on anyway. Or do you stick with Hamilton up there, regardless of who the receiver is? Because a lot of teams have big slots. And if you want to run a small slot up against Hamilton, you have the risk that Hamilton's gonna catch him off the line of scrimmage with those long arms and disrupt the route.
Mm-hmm. It's a good problem to have. You can mix and match, and you can always put Hamilton back at deep safety and put in Maulet if that's the better matchup that you feel that you have, and go back the other way. And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer for that right there right now.
You know, it's interesting. Maulet was a guy who early in camp had made a bunch of plays, and it looked like, okay, maybe this is a guy who can help the Ravens at slot corner. Not playing out there with the starters, but they went through that whole rotation of trying to have Brandon Stevens play slot, and then, you know, bringing Pepe in. Then he got hurt, and then they went to Ardarius Washington, and looked like that was really the answer. And before Ardarius Washington, went to Maulet, actually, and he'd made some plays. And then Maulet got hurt for like 3 weeks of camp, or it seemed like that long anyway. I don't believe he saw any action in the preseason, so he missed all the games. So it might have even been longer than that. And then you really wonder, he made the roster. It was a little bit surprising because he made the roster over Kelly, effectively. And they're cutting loose a fifth-round draft pick to keep a guy who they only own for 1 year. They only have him under contract for this 1 year. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, how good must this guy be that they really believe in him that more? Or maybe how bad is Kelly that he's just not picking things up? That becomes a problem. And they did what apparently was reasonable. They had Maulet with some guaranteed money, and Maulet is a slot corner for sure. He's not an outside guy. I'm so shocked with how well he played in this game relative to where I would have projected him to be in terms of game readiness based on all the time he's missed.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, they just keep installing different players, and they're playing roles very well. And they're, like I was saying earlier, they're just playing great team defense, and it's very disciplined. And no matter what kind of, you know, corners they have out there, they're throwing into very tiny windows right now the way that they're playing. And it's not easy for any offense.
We got a couple more things to talk about here that I want to go into. One, they lost the snap count 65 to 55. By the way, I saw some arguing on Twitter going on between people who said, well, with the Ravens winning the snap count and time of possession like they did, they may have, you know, been ahead in terms of time of position from the run. They sure as heck didn't win snap count in this game. That's an ongoing problem with how the offense has been largely inconsistent at piling up first downs, in particular over the last two games. But the Browns went just 4 of 16 on third down. And the Ravens, while they were at 79% through two games in terms of series success rates, that's the percentage chance that you get a first down or a touchdown after any first down, including the start of a possession. Mm-hmm. They have been in the high 60s, about 68% since those first 2 weeks. And maybe doesn't seem like that would be all the difference in the world. That is all the difference in the world in terms of having a great serious success rate and a, you know, in the 20s kind of serious success rate for the National Football League.
Do you think maybe that's part of the strategy that they had with the Browns is like, we're not going to do anything. We're not going to take any risks that are going to have the Browns make a big play on defense that can potentially cause a turnover that can change the course of the game. Because I mean, the Ravens, you know, part of the great defense that they're playing is they're not giving up long drives. I mean, they driving 40, 50 yards to even get in field goal range against them right now is a very difficult proposition. So let's not give them a short field. Let's, you know, be conservative. Third and eight, sometimes we'll just hand it off and punt and, you know, get them inside the 20 and let our defense do the work, because we're catering to, you know, the unit that's playing the best right now.
First of all, you're right on the money with all of that. All of that is absolutely on the money. And the better team should take less risk, and the leading team should take less risk. And I kind of want to tie this into two good film study mailbag questions we got this week. And so let's knock those off right now. At Ola Dinakin _4 asked, how do you think the DB rotation will be handled once William and Humphrey come back? Does Hamilton stay in the slot to keep Geno on the field? Do you think they keep Stevens as corner 2 or maybe rotate him with Darby and Rakia Sin? All great questions, by the way. I think we just tried our best to answer that. I would foresee, by the way, that Humphrey will be in for a limited amount of snaps in his first game back. Mm-hmm. Seem reasonable?
I would agree with that. Yeah.
And then they'll figure it out. And I hope it just doesn't get figured out for them with injuries. I don't believe that Humphrey is going to stay at slot corner this year. I know it's been something that's been done with him before. He's a very physical player who could be a good slot corner, but I think you lose something in terms of his value if you don't keep him on the outside. Do you have a strong feeling about that?
No. I think the way Hamilton is playing at slot, there's no reason to move Marlon inside. Like in the past, when they've moved Marlon inside, it's kind of been more out of necessity. And with the way Hamilton's playing inside, I think you keep Marlon on the outside and Hamilton on the inside. And I think that's your best combination of slot and outside corner. And then you factor in, you know, whether it's Stone and or Worley or and Marcus Williams when he gets back. That I think that's where you want to keep your safeties, slot corner outside. Yeah.
Okay, so I would have been of the opinion, and I was at the beginning of this year, that you shouldn't let the decision about Stone being a better player than whoever your slot corner is determine where you played Kyle Hamilton, because Kyle Hamilton's a whole different order of magnitude in terms of his potential for superstardom. So playing him at the right position is more important than anything you can do with the cart to drag the horse differently.
Agree. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm not so sure I believe that anymore. Geno has played so well. You know, he's got 2 picks. He looks like an incredible patient center fielder back there. The Ravens seem to be very committed to this cover 2. Geno is the perfect split field safety in cover 2. Great instincts, moves the ball well, loose bracket player, always looking for the overthrow. There's so much I like about him on the back end that I'm not sure if I can get that from Mollett on the front end. So while I think Marcus Williams gives you even more of that on the back end at the other half of the field, I want to keep all 3 of them on the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Same place.
I agree with you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if we have 4 safeties now for, well, sorry, 3 safeties plus Mollett for 3 spots, including slot corner plus 2 safety spots. And we got 4 outside corners for 2 spots. Very, very nice problem to have. And I don't think anybody would have predicted this based on where we were.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Let's get back to your risk question, because I thought that was really good. And I know I had a good question here, and I'm trying to find it here as I'm kind of stumbling over myself. Let me see if I've got it. No, that is not what I want. Oh, darn it. I want to make sure I get this right. So the question basically was this, is should we be concerned about the fact that the Ravens scored 2.3 points per drive in this game against the Browns? Now, 2.3 in past years has been not that great a number. You know, it'd still be okay. It'd be at least the middle of the league. But this year it would be sixth in the entire league. And scoring in 2022 and 23 is significantly depressed. So I promise you we're going to get back to your risk component of this, okay, about not taking risks. So the question is, are there reasons to be concerned about the Ravens only scoring 2.3? Because they certainly were not completely efficient on offense. They were just incredibly efficient in the red zone, as we'll get to. Should we be concerned at all about the 2.3 points per drive in this game against the Browns?
I think to a degree, like, the Ravens are not playing excellent offensive football for the entire year, I would say, and including this game. They have looked good at times, and they have, you know, looked like they're a team that's out of sync at other times. Like, I mean, you go back to the Colts game. That was a game where they really looked out of sync. I mean, the Browns won. Their strongest unit is their defense, and that's one of the top defenses in the league. I mean, going into the game, that was the best defense in the league. I think it just really came down to, let's play discipline. Let's not turn the ball over. Let's not do anything that's going to give the Browns a short field, because we don't believe DTR is going to move the ball on our defense three times down the field to get touchdowns in order to beat us. So we'll take our opportunities when we'll see them, when we have them. Lamar makes, you know, those two or three incredible Lamar plays, and that's how we're going to win this game and just play the field position battle. And I mean, I think that's a game Lamar played. I mean, they were pretty inefficient, but Lamar made a couple of, you know, just those Lamar special plays that makes him so special. It changed the team, changed the game.
I certainly like the notion of putting it in Lamar's hand. The guy who came up with the question was Mark Liu. He's at FOTW85, and he said, you know, should we be concerned about this? I think a good point that he makes is that the red zone success the Ravens have had is unsustainable. I'll get to the exact numbers here in a minute here, but that the Ravens need to move the ball more effectively. And the Ravens series success rate certainly has been low these last couple weeks. And in week three, there wasn't any incentive for that to be low. They were just bad in playing the Colts in terms of moving the ball efficiently, to get only a 2/3 series success rate. It was 20 of 30 last week. This week, it was just a little bit better than that. It was right around 69%. And it was, I think there were contributing factors that were not related to the offense just being lousy or even the Browns defense being good. I think that the primary factor was what you said in terms of risk, that the Ravens for the entire second half, more or less, were making decisions that added win probability at the expense of expected points. So most people look at expected points models and they say, oh, these are the be all end all. But the truth of the matter is the second half of NFL games are largely played for expected win probability and not expected points. And so I don't think it's a very good measure at all for that reason.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, that's, it comes to strategy, and head coaches are trying to win games. They're not trying to pad stats. They're not trying, and sometimes sacrificing yards, sacrificing, you know, going for it on fourth down, or, you know, running the ball on a third down rather than passing, things like that. Or you're trying to run clock. You're trying to kill clock, and you're trying to get to the end of the game and win the game as opposed to putting up more points. I mean, once the Ravens got to that, that Mark Andrews touchdown at right at the end of the half. I mean, that it was over after that. Like,
yeah,
the Browns could have played eight quarters and they were not going to get 20 points. And it was over. So in the second half, it's just don't do anything stupid. Don't turn the ball over. Just run. Just grind this clock out. And if you have to punt, so be it.
Yeah, I want to see what the series success rate was differed by the first and second half, because they also brought in Huntley, who contributed a three and out. I mean, I'm not blaming too much on Tyler in this game, obviously, but in the first half, they had eight first downs and went 3 of 7 on third down. So it looks like they were 8 of 12, not really any difference between the first and second half in terms of doing things. What they benefited from is having a 10-yard field where they made one play and put it in the end zone. That's great. And having two other drives where they got into the red zone and were able to put it in. I guess one of those was a long, no, that was the 10-yard drive, was a long interception return. So anyway, I think we've answered that question probably as well as we can on one show. It might deserve a show of its own out there. So great question, Mark. We really appreciate it. And if you'd like to come on the show and discuss it more, I'd be happy to do that with you. I was going to talk about packages, but I think we hit it all earlier. The 3.8 yards per play in four games. Yeah. Okay. How about the seasonal totals? In four games, they played 247 nickel snaps, and that's out of 276 total snaps, but 26 snaps of base. So that's less than 10%. Three snaps of dime. That's 1%. I'm literally going into conniptions as I hear that, but I understand this is a committed nickel team with Patrick Queen on the team on the field at this point with Roquan for all downs, and 247 nickel snaps. This team does not have a lot of variation in what they've done through 4 weeks, and yet they've been remarkably successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're just playing great team defense. And they're being very disciplined. They've really mastered this nickel defense and the zone defense. It's very encouraging to see. Yeah.
All right, let's move on. Talk quickly about the pass rush and leave all our other discussions. Maybe a couple more mailbag questions for the second segment of this. But four man pass rush was 36 out of 40. Let's divide it up into ample time and space, BOQ and pressure, which are the three groups that I define. So those 40, 15 ample time and space opportunities is a lot. It's about 38%. You would expect a quarterback to have more of those when you're, running a committed four-man pass rush, because you're just not going to get home every time with somebody and within 3 seconds. And he had 15 times where he had that kind of pocket. Now, here's the good news. 15 of those opportunities, even though he wasn't sacked or anything like that, didn't have any negative plays, and in fact didn't have any turnovers. He could have a turnover there. He threw for only 94 yards or 6.3 yards per play. That is not very good with ample time and space. In fact, that's quite bad. Normally I'd want somebody to be in the between 8 and maybe 10 and a half yards per play with ATS.
Mm-hmm.
All right, move on. The ball was out quickly 7 times, total of 13 yards on those plays. So 1.9 yards per play. That's absolutely terrible, and included an interception. In fact, it's beyond terrible. The one team that seemed to have modest success with that was the Bengals, who were right around 5 yards per play against the Ravens in those a ball out quick opportunity. So relatively few of those. Thompson, despite a high incentive to do so, didn't get rid of the ball quickly too much in this game.
Mm-hmm.
And then of 40 passes, they had 18 pressures. And this is one of the most astounding numbers I've ever seen. Total yardage, I want to make sure I get this right here. Total yardage on the 18 pressures. No, take me to it. I'll get there just 1 second. Was minus 34 net yards. So there were some sacks in there, and that's I have this wrong in my article. I'll make sure I go correct this, but it's negative 1.9 yards per play. There have been some bad numbers in the past, and I know at Tennessee when they sacked Mariota 11 times, they might have had a number like that, but that's just an incredible number for one football game.
Yeah, it's pretty bad all around for DTR. it kind of like he just didn't look like he was ready to play a football game. And I'm gonna go back about 20 years on this, but he just reminded me Spurgeon Winn, who actually played for the Browns, who was just an all-time just terrible performance against the Ravens 20 years ago, and it was just not ready to play. And same with ETR. He just wasn't ready to play, and the Ravens just absolutely killed him. You're on mute, Ken.
It wouldn't be a film study, a podcast without that. So Spurgeon Winn, I believe, played in the playoffs against the Ravens with Denver. I may be thinking about the wrong guy. In 2000. Is that the one, or the 35-0 loss to the Browns?
No. This was another that I don't think he played with any other team after the Browns. But this was 2000 or 2001 when he played with the Browns, and it was just an all-time bad performance.
Okay, I am too fascinated by this. Okay, spelled it wrong. Let's look at those game logs for his career. So I know he was, in 2000, he played some for Denver, played in the playoffs when the Ravens injured a couple other quarterbacks. Brian Griese was out, and then he came in. But with the Browns in 2001, that could be it. He had a terrible game. His passer rating was 23.2 in that game. So that could well be it. But, all right. Very cool. So that's a good analogy. The Ravens, by the way, in terms of pass rush, they rushed four, most of the times we said 36 out of 40, but they also didn't blitz much. Six individual plays. They had some form of a blitz. Most of that was a zone blitz where they're trying to bring one guy from off ball and drop somebody from the other side to overload a side. So they did some of that to try and mess it up, but only six times. That's 0.15 off ball blitzes per play, which is very, very low. They had seven plays with a stunt, six singles and one pair. That did include four pressures. They're pretty effective. I expect some of those were called on the field by the defenders. So it's not something that had to be called for the sidelines. They probably were having a little bit of fun, frankly, in that second half, getting after the quarterback in some different ways. And there was another question, I'll try and get the name right, about who noticed that the Ravens used Clowney inside on several plays while having either Matabike or even Travis Jones on the outside, on the outside shoulder of the tackle on some plays. Having played defensive line, what do you think they're trying to accomplish with that kind of a formation?
You want to match up Clowney's quickness on a slower guard. And you're more or less trying to get a quick inside pass rush to rattle a quarterback, getting his throwing zone quicker and with a quicker guard, with a quicker defensive end, and you're kind of sacrificing your edge pass rush, and you just hope that bigger guy can collapse the pocket around the tackle more.
Does it, and I didn't actually notice if this were the plays or not where they stunted, but does it set you up for a TE stunt or a TE twist of some sort?
It's generally not really, but some will, some won't. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, fair enough.
I don't remember. I'll have to go back and look. I don't remember Clowney lining up at the defensive tackle position, but I do remember a couple of times where they did some kind of stun and he came on the inside through that. So yeah, I'll
have to go definitely
back
did that.
Try
yeah.
to check. Yeah, I'll have to go back and check that out.
I think it would have all been in the second half, and it would have been between maybe two and four plays, I would say, in total. Because I think I noticed it a minimum of two times.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Zero simulated pressures is the other name of this. Now, that's a staple of the Ravens defense, is to drop guys from the line of scrimmage in two or more to try and really confuse the opposing offensive line. You know, solid offensive line in terms of what Cleveland showed. I think the Ravens out-physicaled them in the middle, and they really had some good pass rush from the inside. You mentioned that earlier, but I guess I would also say that I'm a little surprised that they didn't try and mess up DTR more by showing him simulated pressures, other than it obviously it does create a disadvantage potentially for your linebackers dropping back into coverage.
Yeah. I think DTR showed exactly that he was not ready to play, and they were like, let's not do anything to give him any kind of confidence. If he even shows anything that he can beat our base coverage, then maybe we'll throw some blitzes, throw a little trickery in there to confuse him a little bit. But there was no need to do any of that. Just play base. Don't give up a big play and dare him to beat us, which he was just not able to do.
Yeah. All right, Brandon, just a tremendous amount of fun having this discussion with you. Really appreciate you coming on the show and doing the defense, where you clearly have a, you know, personal stake and a background in. Tell folks where they can talk football with you online.
Sure. I'm on Twitter at Brandon Croxton 5, and a big fan and love talking Ravens.
All right. Outstanding. Other folks out there, if you'd like to be on a film study short, I'm going to make a big push this offseason to vet any analytic models on a regular basis people want to hear. And I realize that's not everybody's cup of tea, but I'm talking about at least one per week, where it's either nationally published things, or if you have something that's local, more Ravens-centric, I'd love to hear from you on that. Anyway, DMs are always open on Twitter. Hit me up. It's content I really enjoy as someone who comes from that kind of background, and I'll be sure to get back to you very quickly. Brandon, thanks again for coming on.
All right, great. Thank you.
And we'll talk to you in part two in just a few minutes.